another person who suffered from Steinbach was a young person who was 6 months away from getting his PhD, and he was caught by Steinbach, the story is, having sexual intercourse with another graduate student in Steinbach's lab. And as a result, they were both banished from the laboratory. And although the male had finished his PhD, wrote his thesis, he couldn't get a job because Steinbach wouldn't write a letter of recommendation for him. So he drove a taxi cab in Madison for quite a while until Carl Baumann took pity on him and intervened and got him a job somewhere in the Chicago area. But
This was in the 40s.
And Steinbach, reacted in a severe way. But as you point out, this was the temper of the times, and I don't know whether Steinbach would react that way today or not, but most professors wouldn't react that way now. But I'm sure there are lots of interesting stories that could be written. Steinbach was tolerant in some ways when he accepted somebody and he thought they were worth his time, then he would tolerate things perhaps more readily than in someone he didn't know. Mm-hmm. There were times when he knew that we weren't following his rules. For example, if he left at 5 o'clock in the afternoon because we hadn't been able to make any noise all day long, all hell would break loose. Out would come the ping pong ball and we'd shoot baskets up on the wall or something to let off steam. Well, there are a couple of times he came back in and saw us, but he purposely diverted his head down so that he didn't have to come and say anything. There are a number of instances like that where he obviously did not want to come and heckle, and even though he knew we were breaking his rules.
When you say 8 to 5, mm-hmm. is there time out for
Oh yes, lunch or, you didn't have to work steadily or anything of that sort.
But that's a long period to
concentrate for. Well, you were expected to be in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. You'd read or you'd do some work at your bench or you go to classes. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are expected activities. Yeah. But it's not like now a graduate student would feel free now to disappear at 3 in the afternoon because they might come in and work at 6 o'clock at night or whatever. Mm-hmm. No one pays any attention because what we think of now is how much work they get done at the end of 6 months. If they aren't working, it becomes obvious. Mm-hmm. And some experiments require different timing, and so you can't put it on an 8-to-5 basis. But that was how he and Elvium and Hart and I don't know about Phillips, but that's how they ran their labs. Yeah.
I'd like to ask you just one question about your own work, which is mm-hmm. not regular. The idea of looking beyond vitamin D to find out where the Dutch, when you got the notice, had you thought of that before?
Oh, sure. That's
had.
We had. I mean, the reason I synthesized radio-labeled vitamin D in 62 to 3 was that I wanted to find out whether vitamin D was active as such or whether it was changed by the body before it works. Mm. And so we followed logical steps. We first made the radio label D. We first showed that vitamin D disappeared. We showed that other materials that had the label now appeared and you could separate them. Then we tested them for biological activity. They were active. That's when we published all of these results, and that's when the Dutch came and said, aha, we want that stuff. And well, that made us work night and day. And that they were here March 11, 19, The Dutch.
66 or?
No, that's when we were doing our work. It was March 11, 1968, I think.
Mm-hmm. So you realized that you were really racing with them.
Yeah, so we worked night and day. This little Japanese girl right next to her, she was a technician at that time, Yoko Tanaka, and John Blunt, a postdoc from New Zealand, chemist. And so we worked night and day from that point on until on May 7 we had the structure. I mean, that was one era in the time I was in the lab that we didn't make a single mistake. There was not a single mistake. Everything, I mean, things couldn't have gone better. And I remember John Blunt gave up on the preparation about mid-April because he couldn't get it pure. And so I came in at night and took a sample and worked out the partition coefficient, and I thought, my God, we can separate this on a reverse phase column. And I made one, and the next morning we put part of the preparation on there, and sure enough the yellow junk stayed on the column and the radioactivity came through. And I remember we were standing there and I said, look, John, there's nothing in this tube, you know. And but what I meant was there's no junk in the tube. And that was clean enough, and we right away took some spectra and we could tell that it was clean. And then that was on a Wednesday or something like that. The next day we got NMR spectra over in chemistry on their 100 megahertz instrument, and we sent a sample to Dr. Schnoes, who had not yet joined the staff but was at Berkeley. And we asked him if he'd run a mass spectrum on it, because we didn't have a mass spec in the department. And so before he called back, we had worked out the structure here already. We already knew what it was. And so when he called back, we said, well, how does 25-hydroxy vitamin D sound as far as your mass spectrum is concerned? He said, that's got to be it. That was it. So we went to Wharf and we went ahead and got quick permission from NIH to file a patent application. We wrote up the paper quickly and sent it in. And the Dutch hadn't even started yet. We beat them by years, I guess. So that was it. That was an exciting time in the lab. Yeah. That was the beginning.
And you were actually in on it.
Oh, yeah. No, I was working in the lab in the 60s. I worked in the lab till the mid-70s, I'd say. Mm. I just couldn't do it anymore. Now there's too much administration, too much grantsmanship, and too much writing reports. And you can't.
But you still supervise.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm out there talking. And, yeah. No, it's.
You said that you pointed next door and said the Japanese girl.
Yeah,
she's still here.
What would happen is that she continued to work as a technician. Her husband was getting his degree in bacteriology. Mm-hmm. And he succeeded in getting his degree. And in the meantime, we kept doing really great experiments. And there was enough data that Yoko asked me if I would object if she took what she had done, put it together in a thesis and submit it to a Japanese university for a PhD. They can do that. Mm-hmm. And would I consent to being a visiting professor? And I said, of course, why not? You deserve it. Mm-hmm. And so she got a PhD from Nagoya University about 1976. So then I took her on as a postdoc, and she's in the scientist category now.
Oh, I see. So
she can't, she's Japanese. She can't handle English very well. So she's not a faculty kind of person. Mm-hmm. Her husband's on the staff at Food Research Institute.
Mm-hmm.